Good evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. We're bringing you episode 43 tonight on January 22nd, 2015. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Ray Goodwin.
We are having another good show tonight. I'm always saying that, but some of these parts in these shows are just really fantastic to me, and I can't wait to get into some of this material that we have tonight. How about you, Ray?
Oh, I feel the same, Carolyn. It's amazing, too. Our readings tonight concern July 4th, 1942, and a little bit lengthy, and so we may just get through July the 5th at dinner, which is only covers 2 days. We might possibly get into the 6th, but boy, in that short period of time right there, there's so much great material to talk about.
Yes, there is. And, you know, I think it just keeps getting better. It feels to me like conversations have gotten better from the beginning when we started. There's an awful lot of criticism of Christianity in the beginning, but it seems like what he says about it later on is more interesting than what he said about it in the beginning. So things are kind of, who knows, it kind of reflects what was going on with Adolf Hitler during these war years.
You know, he's gotten more into it and more definitive about why he has an argument with the church. And you start to see, as we will again this evening, that he recognizes the church for exactly what it is, just another power entity that wants a slice of the pie, that wants to be able to tell the state what it can and can't do. And he recognized that a long time ago. And, you know, initially his criticisms about Christianity seemed to be based more on certainly his emotional feelings, and he had his reasons. But as we go further and further, when they're mentioned again in criticism, it's more of a this is why, and more factual and more understandable to me.
Yeah, I think so. I just feel like we're getting a wonderful close image, a close picture of Adolf Hitler and how he thinks, and, you know, over the whole course of this. A lot of things are developing. Well, and I also decided when I was listening to the intro music tonight that I should mention once in a while for people who are far away from the very beginning of this show that our intro and outro music is from Richard Wagner, and it's Siegfried's Idol. It's a selection, two different little selections from Siegfried's Idol, which is a piece that he wrote on the birth of his son, Siegfried, and actually was in honor of his wife, you know, Cosima, who was on the day that she delivered their son. So it's a beautiful, beautiful piece of music. And I think most people can tell, if you're familiar with Wagner, that it is Wagner, but a lot of people wouldn't know that. So I thought it'd be proper to mention that tonight, and every once in a while, that's what they're hearing. All right, well, you know, there's not very many timelines tonight, which is quite unusual. So I do have one, though, to begin with, for the fourth. It's very short, the first air missions by American Air Force in Europe. Yes, the first time they went up in the air on some missions, the Americans, in Europe on the 4th of July. 1942.
Okay. You know, one thing I'd like to talk to you about before we start into the reading, just to maybe lay a little groundwork on it. This first section is about the concordat between the Catholic Church and the different German states that had been in effect for quite a long time, a number of centuries. And as I understand it, what that deal was when Christianity spread via the only church at that time, of course, the Catholic Church, into Europe, up from Rome and further into Europe and into these German states, and people converting to Christianity and all this, the concordat was signed with the Catholic Church by these individual German states that the church would provide bishops, priests, leadership, things like this, and the pathway and the roadmap to get to heaven. And the German state was obligated then to kick in a certain amount of money to that Catholic Church for that service that they were supposed to be receiving from the church. And this had been in effect for a pretty good while. And so when Hitler's talking here a little bit about so much money going to the church from the states, you know, that has to stop, because this is not the situation anymore. There aren't these small German states, and that concordat was made with those small German states. It was not made with the German Reich.
Yeah, but he made one when he came into power.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not the old concordat. Those were, that's true what you said, but he made a new one with them. He had his, who was that guy that you've talked about so many times? He had him go as a representative and work it out, and when it was signed in the Vatican.
Yeah, I think he referenced that about, to me, it's like he said they took that to mean that this was that we had to honor the old, or this was based on the old concordat, but that was not the case, because the situation wasn't that way anymore, and that concordat he had signed with them was at the time, I think, an action of expediency that was to be addressed more seriously later. Anyway, but I appreciate you bringing that up about the newer concordat.
Yeah. In fact, it was very, very important and very much, he very much wanted it, because he wanted to have, what he was doing with that was to keep the church happy in their own place. And to, you know, and to recognize them and to keep them out of state business. But he's saying you can't keep them out of that. And so certain things have happened that he decided has made it obsolete. So we'll see.
Yes.
We'll go through this and discuss it as we go along. It's pretty darn
good.
Interesting, this first part.
Exactly. Okay, we'll start with a 4th of July, 1942, at dinner. German Embassy at the Vatican. Interpretations of the Concordat. My relations with the Papal Nuncio. Americans stand no nonsense from the Church. A milliard a year into the pockets of the priests. The Concordat must be ended. Faulty maneuvers by the Wilhelmstrasse. I refuse open war with the Church. An account to be settled with Bishop von Galen. The bishops will soon fawn on the state. Should we decide to recall...
I just want to mention that the Papal Nuncio is a title for an ecclesiastical diplomat, because he mentions that a lot. And the Papal Nuncio for Hitler in the beginning was the man who became the Pope. I think, unless I'm wrong somehow, but it seems like it. That's it. Who became Pope Pius XII. But before that, he was something in Germany, and he was the one who was dealing with representing the Vatican to Hitler.
That's right.
And so it's
right.
Like an envoy, an envoy from the Vatican to a state or an international organization. And it's usually an archbishop, which is what he was. He had all kinds of titles.
Suffice to say, he was the primary representative of the Vatican to Germany, to Hitler.
Right.
Okay.
Well put.
Should we decide to recall our representative from the Vatican, I can see no adequate reason for sending any fresh incumbent to this embassy. The relations between Germany and the Vatican are based on the Concordat. But this same Concordat is no more than the survival of agreements reached between the Vatican and the different German states. And with the disappearance of the latter and their incorporation in the German Reich, it has become obsolete. It is true that it has as its basis these various agreements, but it is a confirmation of past agreements rather than a current agreement in force. I am therefore of the considered opinion that the juridical consequence of the disappearance of the sovereignty of the individual German states and its incorporation in the sovereignty of the Reich render the continuation of diplomatic relations with the Vatican redundant. From military reasons connected with the war, I have so far refrained from translating this conception into fact. Equally, however, I have shown myself unresponsive to the attempts of the Vatican towards the extension of the provisions of the Concordat to embrace the newly acquired territories of the Reich. The Saar, Sudetenland, Bohemia and Moravia, the Reichsgau, Danzig East Prussia, the Warthegau, a large part of Silesia and Alsace-Lorraine, have in fact no relations with the Roman Catholic Church, which are supported by formal international agreement. In these territories, therefore, church affairs must be settled locally. If the papal nuncio seeks audience of the Foreign Office and tries through this channel to gain some say in religious developments in the new territories, his advances must be rejected. He must be told clearly that in the absence of any particular concordat, the settlement of church affairs in these territories is a matter to be settled exclusively between the relevant state representative, that is, the Reichsstatthalter, and the head of the local ecclesiastical body.
Now, let's just say here, Ray, that for one thing, the papal nuncio now is not what was Pacelli, but because he became pope in 1939. So between 1933 and 1939, he was the representative to Hitler. But then he became the pope. So then Hitler had a new one. So the person he's talking about now is not Pacelli, who became Pope Pius XII. I have to admit, you know, when I read that first part, and then I kind of went on to so many other things that I forgot about it, what he was saying there, and I was confused about it. I didn't quite understand what he was meaning there, and I should have really looked into it more. And I do know that, like you know, that there was the older one between the different German states. But yet there was such a big deal made out of the agreement in 1933 between Hitler's new regime and the Catholic Church, and this big signing ceremony is all the Concordat. I don't really understand why he's saying here that this is this agreement is left over from the past and no longer has any
clout to it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not even, I can't think of the right words, but he says it right here. It's a past agreement. And based on that, he can render it obsolete. I don't get that at all, I must say.
I think that it has to do with the fact in the early days of the Reich in 1933, when this signing took place and all, Hitler's government was not in a position to exert itself in the field of the relationship with the Church and Vatican as it would like to have done, because of the, you know, just this world situation and the way a lot of people were portraying the National Socialists as atheistic, anti-Christian, things like that, and saying that they were anti-Church. So, you know, it was anything to make peace with the Church and say, okay, look, we can exist together, we can get along together. And I think it was, as I said earlier, probably more a matter of expediency that was to be dealt with later. And as time has gone on now, this is 9 years later, the war certainly have changed things, and things are in a little bit different shape here. Now, he also, you know, there's nothing that can be done while the war is going on, but he's such a forward thinker, he's a long-range thinker, that he knows that when this war is over, this is going to have to be faced and dealt with. And so it's good to hear him talk about this at this point, because it's letting you know that it's on his mind. Don't you worry, I haven't forgotten about this. And I'm going to, I know it's going to have to be dealt with. And the way things are progressing here, I think it's time to get more firm and tough. And that's what I saw in the
first part. Well, yeah, definitely that's what he's saying. But here, under Reich's Concordat, spelt in a German way on Wikipedia, the Reich's Concordat. So that would be the concordant between, the Third Reich and the Church. It says it's a treaty between the Holy See and and Germany negotiated during its transition into Nazi Germany. Well, it was signed on July 20th, 1933. Well, the way they talk here, this last thing I said was stupid. But July 20th, he took power in January, so 6 months later, you know, it was signed with Pacelli, who later became Pope Pius on behalf of the present Pope, and Franz von Papen, that's the one, remember, we've talked about so many times. He was vice chancellor at that point, and Hitler had him take care of it. And President Paul von Hindenburg, on behalf of the German government, respectively. I guess Hitler didn't have his total control yet. And it just guarantees the rights of the Roman Catholic Church in Germany. And the church was saying later that they didn't intend to endorse Hitler's government or National Socialism or anything. They only signed that in order to guarantee the rights of the Catholics in Germany, so that they wouldn't, you know, and nothing would be done to prevent them from practicing their faith and so on. And so it got kind of controversial later on, but I still don't understand what Hitler's saying here in the beginning, but maybe as we go on, he talks about it quite a bit, maybe we'll get a better picture of it.
Yeah, and his attitude was changing more all the time because of the criticisms that were coming out of the Catholic Church.
Yeah, and that was quite a bit later, though, because in the beginning, it was all going along quite smoothly. Everybody acted like they were just so, you know, working it all out together, so happy together. And you even had bishops and people like that. They were the Catholics, too, holding their arm up in the Nazi and the Roman salute, if you want to call it that, when they, at certain times, they were going right along with it, and the Protestants were too. He had something different with the Protestant Church, not the Concordat. But the basic thing to understand is that he became disillusioned, like you said, and it was because they started criticizing his government.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he was trying to prevent with all this. He was willing to, give them money, which is traditional though in Europe and in Germany. They always donated large amounts of money to the church from the government, and he did all that, but they started anyway not liking some of his policies, and that finally really infuriated him because it made a big impression overseas. You know, if the church in Germany was critical of what he was doing is like immoral, came out on moral grounds.
That's a good point.
He thought they should be loyal to the state, and they weren't being that. And so he said, in my mind what became obsolete to him. He called it obsolete, but he didn't care to keep it up.
Right.
Anymore. Yeah.
A lot of what the church was doing was exactly what you said. It was giving the enemies of Germany something to beat them over the head with to the rest of the world.
Right. So it was kind of a disloyalty in his mind.
Yes.
Of course, their loyalty was to their religious principles and what have you, so that they weren't... they want power, but they don't want... they want to act like they're above politics, too.
Yeah, and see, Hitler saw that as pure hypocrisy, taking money from the state and a lot of money at that, and then, talking against the government, talking against the state, against its policies.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't blame him for getting infuriated about it.
Okay.
He says, I should, of course, have preferred Minister Lammers to impart this information to the papal nuncio. Unfortunately, the Wilhelmstrasse, with its usual greed for fields of fresh authority, has allowed itself to be imposed upon by the papal legate. Well, I shall be interested to see how these gentlemen get themselves out of the tangle. Regulations framed to cover the whole Reich cannot but make more difficult the clarification of relations between state and church, at which we are aiming. For the Catholic Church strives always to seek advantage where we are weakest by demanding the application to the whole Reich of those of the various concordats which conform most closely to its aspirations. Therefore, as regards future relations between state and church, it is very satisfactory from our point of view that in nearly half the Reich, negotiations can now be conducted by the appropriate Reichsstatthalter, unfettered by the clauses of the Central Concordat. For this means that in each district, the Gauleiter can, according to the degree of emancipation acquired by the population of his Gau, lead the people forward step by step in the sense that we desire. And here the book says, note by translator, the diatribe which occupies the next few paragraphs is couched in most bitter and often vulgar terms. Throughout, Hitler uses the opprobrious term Pfaffe, in one case Pfaffengeschmeiß, of which there is no direct English equivalent. The translator has tried to reproduce the atmosphere of the passage.
Now, I want to just make my comment about this, because now let's remember, this is the translator. This is not Henry Picker, who's there at the time taking his notes. This is these two English translators, because this book was put out, you know, in England by English people, who are saying this and trying to make out like, oh, it's so vulgar. Well, whatever he came up with, something like the word damn and something like that.
Yes.
I don't know. You know, it wasn't so bad. It's just amazing how they put that in there and have to warn people, oh, this is going to be some terrible Hitler stuff here, you know. Hitler's getting mad. I think it's pretty interesting to hear him speak when he is mad. You know he's mad.
That's exactly right.
It frustrates him. The church is just frustrating the heck out of him. He can hardly even be in the presence of these church representatives, he said, anymore. He doesn't want to see them. Because he might start to go after them, you know, and he doesn't want to show anger. He doesn't want to call them names or anything. So, you know, he just prefers to just not even deal with them.
Right.
I can understand that.
And the Führer goes on. Although in general I hold no brief for the Americans, I must in this respect take off my hat to them. The American statesmen, by subjecting the church to the same regulations governing all other associations and institutions, have limited its field of activity to reasonable proportions. And as the state does not contribute from state funds one single cent to the church, the whole clergy cringes and sings hymns in praise of the government. This is not to be wondered at. The parson, like everyone else, has got to live. What he makes out of the public offertory doesn't amount to much, and so he is more or less dependent on state charity. As he has no legal claim whatever on the state, he therefore takes very good care that his demeanor is always pleasing in the eyes of the state, and therefore deserving of the crumbs it cares to toss to him. Once we cease handing out the milliards of marks a year to the church, our damn parsons will very quickly change their tune. And instead of having the impudence to revile us and attack us in the most shameful manner, will very soon be eating out of our hands. We can make this clerical gang go the way we want, quite easily, and at far less cost than the present. Contributions should be made to selected individual parsons. If we give some bishop, for himself and his subordinates, a round million, he will pocket the first $300,000 for his own use. Otherwise, he's no true parson. The distribution of the meager rest among the parsons of his whole diocese will cause a pretty little uproar among the whole brood and leave us laughing like hell. In one respect, however, we must remain absolutely obdurate. Any petitions for state intervention must be rejected out of hand. Justification for such rejection is obvious. On its own showing, the church knows full well that no profane spirits could possibly succeed in mediating in church affairs as well as the clergy itself. How can you expect some wretched little government jack in office like myself, to whom the light has not been vouchsafed, to tackle so vital and intricate a problem?
More of that wonderful Hitler
sarcasm.
Sarcasm, right. Yeah.
Agreement as to distribution of funds must, as in other agreements, be left in the hand of the Reichsstatthalter. I don't think we need fear that they will enter upon any commitments which are directed against either the state or its interests. For one thing, the Gauleiters are under firm control, and for another, most of the Reichsstatthalters are much stricter in these affairs than I am. Once the war is over, we will put a swift end to the Concordat. It will give me the greatest personal pleasure to point out to the Church all those occasions on which it has broken the terms of it. One need only recall the close cooperation between the Church and the murderers of Heydrich. Catholic priests not only allowed them to hide in a church on the outskirts of Prague, but even allowed them to entrench themselves in the sanctuary of the altar. The development of relations between state and church affords a very instructive example of how the carelessness of a single statesman can have after effects which last for centuries. When Charlemagne was kneeling at prayer in St. Peter's Rome at Christmas in the year 800, the Pope, giving him no time to work out the possible effects of so symbolic an action, suddenly bent down and presto, popped a golden crown on his head. By permitting it, the emperor delivered himself and his successors into the hands of a power which subjected the German government and the German people to 500 years of martyrdom. Today, as always, there are responsible people to be found who are careless enough to allow a crown of gold to be popped onto their heads, and one cannot exaggerate the enormous effects which such an action, seeming trifling at the time, can later produce. Much in the same class and equally stupid is the idea of the Wilhelmstrasse that every note from the Vatican must be answered. The very act of answering is tantamount to an admission of the right of the Vatican to interfere in German domestic issues, if only in ecclesiastical issues, and to maintain official correspondence with us. Not only the history of the past, but also present times, afford numberless examples of the very hard-boiled diplomats to be found in the service of the Catholic Church, and of how extremely cautious one must be in dealing with them. Just after my entry into Vienna, I heard a tremendous whistling and cheering under my window, and was told that it was for Cardinal Archbishop Innitzer, who was on his way to visit me. I expected to see a wretched little parson, downcast and oppressed with the burden of his sins, instead of which there appeared a man who addressed me with self-assurance and a beaming countenance, just as if, throughout the whole period of the Austrian Republic, he had never even touched a single hair on the head of any National Socialist. Let me add, however, that once one has come into contact with gentlemen of this type, one soon learns to recognize them on sight. The Papal Nuncio, on whom, as doyen of the diplomatic corps, falls the duty of delivering the congratulatory address at the New Year's ceremony, invariably tries to use the occasion to turn the conversation to the position of the Catholics in Germany. But I always manage to sidestep him, asking him in a most amiable and pressing manner for news of the health of His Holiness, and, when this engrossing subject has been dealt with, turning hastily to greet the remainder of the diplomatic corps. Except at this reception, I have on principle always refused to meet the Papal Nuncio and fob him off onto Lammers instead. I have thus succeeded in withdrawing myself from all personal contact with the Vatican. During the years of our struggle, Rosenberg once submitted to me the draft of a leading article he proposed publishing in reply to the attacks of the Catholic Church. I forbade him to publish it, and I still think it was a great mistake that Rosenberg ever let himself be drawn into a battle of words with the Church. He had absolutely nothing to gain from it. The hesitant Catholics of their own free will regard the Church with a critical eye, and from the truly devout, not only could he expect no fair hearing for his heretical outpourings, but he must also have realized that the opposition propaganda would condemn him for his meddling in matters of faith and successfully point to him as a man guilty of mortal sin. The fact that I remain silent in public over church affairs is not in the least misunderstood by the sly foxes of the Catholic Church. And I'm quite sure that a man like the Bishop von Galen knows full well that after the war I shall extract retribution to the last farthing. And if he does not succeed in getting himself transferred in the meanwhile to the Collegium Germanicum in Rome, he may rest assured that in the balancing of our accounts, no T will remain uncrossed, no I undotted. The attitude of the Bishop von Galen affords just one more argument in favor of terminating the Concordat after the war, substituting for it regional regulations, and immediately withholding from the Church the financial support at present guaranteed to it by that treaty. I am sure it will give my Reichstadthalters great pleasure to inform some bishop who, from the state's point of view, has strayed from the straight and narrow path, that the Reichsgau, owing to a temporary lack of funds, is unfortunately, and to his own personal deep regret, compelled temporarily to stop such contributions as it was in the habit of making from time to time. When once the Concordat and its financial obligations have been repudiated and the Church becomes dependent on the offertory, it will pocket a bare 3% of the money it at present gets from the state, and all the bishops will come creeping and begging to the Reichstadthalter. It will be the duty of the Reichstadthalter to make it quite clear after the war that he will deal with the Church in exactly the same way as he deals with any other national association, and that he will not tolerate the intervention of any foreign influence. The papal nuncio can then return happily to Rome. We shall be saved the expense of an embassy at the Vatican, and the only people who will weep tears over the jobs that have been lost will be the Foreign Office. Telling it like it is, isn't he?
He's always getting in his jabs at the Foreign Office, too.
Yeah, the bureaucrats.
Yeah. Well, that's a great, boy, that's a great section there. What did you, I've got a couple of comments I can make pretty quickly and then let you take over.
Go ahead,
okay.
Please do.
What did I write? Oh, yeah. When he's speaking, you know, going back to that translator talking about Hitler's vulgarity, you know, there was no vulgarity in that, just a little bit of way you would normally talk. Boy, if you think about some of these politicians and the way they talk off the record, you know, and amongst their own people. And, of course, there was. I first was thinking that there was nobody more vulgar probably than Roosevelt. But then I said, oh, Carolyn, no, Churchill takes the cake for absolute vulgarity. What a vulgar man he was. And nobody complains about, well, they do mention it, but they don't mention it in the same way that this was mentioned here with Hitler. It's just God. But then the other thing I wanted to mention was, let's see if I can get it straight, Rosenberg and the
article that he wrote.
Yeah. Well, his book, you know, and Hitler saying that.
Well, I think it probably had to do with where he says it was a great mistake Rosenberg ever let himself be drawn into the church. Yeah.
But I don't know. I had some other thought about that. I'll just go on to Bishop von Galen. What Bishop von Galen did really, really hit Hitler hard, and it hurt him a lot because Hitler had to change his policies because of von Galen speaking out in the church. Now, he was a Protestant, the top one in the country, about about the euthanasia program, and he had to pull out of that, and he wasn't happy about that. So I think, I don't know what else Bishop von Galen did that was, he did a lot of things, but that's the one that stands out most in my mind and made the regime look like it was doing something terrible in a sense that they even now make out that that was the first moves of the Holocaust, of gassing people in concentration camps and so on. You know, he's talked about Galen before, and here he's putting it very bluntly that he's gonna even get back at this guy after the war.
Hope he gets transferred.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I can remember what I wanted to say about Rosenberg, I'll bring it up.
Okay, all I have to say about it was, I thought, what an example. I mean, I would never have given this a thought, and where Hitler says the carelessness of a single statesman can have after effects which last for centuries. Then he describes Charlemagne kneeling in prayer in St. Peter's at Rome in the year of 800. And while he's kneeling in prayer, the Pope, and as he says here, giving Charlemagne no time to work out the possible effects of so symbolic an action, suddenly bent down, put a gold crown on his head. Now, when you think about that a moment, Carolyn, it's like, had the Pope not done that, had Charlemagne stood up, you see, they were then they were equal powers, you know, for the people to look upon. You got the emperor, you got Charlemagne, and you have the church, and they're two equal power entities. But when Charlemagne's kneeling in prayer, and the Pope rushes over and puts this gold crown on his head, well, it's like everybody, you know, knows what's happened and says, oh my, then what the Pope is saying, I'm allowing you to do this. I am crowning you, Emperor, you know, I'm giving you this golden crown. But what that meant was to suddenly elevate the Pope and the Vatican a position of more authority and power than the Emperor. And I thought that was a heck of an example of exactly what he said, how one little thing with one statesman saddled us with, 800 years of... Or 500 more years of martyrdom, you know, the German people. So I thought that was a great example.
Yeah, that stood out to me, too. I agreed with that, and that's a very wise observation of Hitler's, that when you accept certain things, that's like, it's the same idea as, they're totally different, but when we're told that by accepting a social security number when you're born, which now they give that you can't avoid it, but you used to choose to do it. You know, when we were young, we did it some certain point, turned 13, 14, 15 or something. But you've accepted that this government, the United States government, has all this power over you, and that you are a member of this, and you are now one of the people who owes the money that the national debt is everybody owes thousands of dollars, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, in government debt, you know, and it's all going to be extracted from the people, because the government is supposedly the people. So when you do a thing like that, you're being pulled into their thing, and that's what Hitler's saying here. It's a really powerful, it has a basic application to all kinds of.
That's really a good parallel, because, you know, it seems so innocuous at the first, you know, well, how hard, this is a harmless thing. It's what this is doing is signing me up to be eligible in my older age for some of this money that I'm paying in. Right. Like this, it seems rather innocuous. And you drew a good parallel with the Charlemagne thing here. I think that works.
Yeah, I think it does too.
All right, we shall move on to 4th of July, 1942, at dinner. Two men in advance of their time, naming battleships, stronger collaboration from Czechoslovakia. Those who are not for me are against me. I think it is very astonishing that men like Ulrich von Hutten and Goetz von Berlichingen should have been so far in advance of their times and so progressive in their ideas. And it's a great pity that they had behind them in their struggle no strong and concrete doctrine which would have given them the necessary moral elan and perseverance. Their completely German outlook, nevertheless, entitles them to a high place in the esteem of the German people. I have, for this reason, suggested that battleships or other large warships at present under construction should be named after them.
Let me just mention here real quick that Ulrich von Hutten was born in 1488 and died in 1523. So he's going way back in time here. And he was a German scholar, poet, and reformer, and an outspoken critic of the Roman Catholic Church. And a few other things he says about him. He was a knight. He was the leader of the Imperial Knights of the Holy Roman Empire. And this Goetz von Berlichingen is he was also from that period, 1480 to 1562, and he was from Württemberg, and he was a mercenary and a fighter all his life, and active kind of in war scenarios, and active in many feuds, and he lost his right arm in one battle, and got a metal-looking false arm with fingers, you know, it looked like a piece of armor on his arm, but sort of worked, I guess. And these are really tough. These are, you know, these are people that Hitler really admires, looking back in history, the kind of Germans he likes.
Right.
So,
and,
yeah.
And, of course, this is about naming battleships or warships, and and he's using them as a great example that deserve it. And he says, I rejected the suggestion that a battleship should be named after myself, because if such a ship has bad luck, the superstitious would regard it as an unfavorable omen for my own activities. Imagine a battleship named after me having to spend 6 months in dry dock for repairs. Look, for example, at the very harmful effect the announcement of the destruction of Fort Stalin at Sebastopol had on the Russian morale. In a state which is founded on a concrete political philosophy, prudence must be exercised in the naming of warships. October Revolution, Marat, the Commune of Paris in the Soviet Navy, is an example of what I mean. I have therefore ordered that the battle cruiser Deutschland should be renamed, for the loss of a ship of that name would cause greater consternation than the loss of any other ship. For the same reason, I will not allow the names of anyone associated with the National Socialist movement or philosophy to be used for any warships. After a man like Getz von Berlichingen, on the other hand, you can name as many great ships as you like, for such is his popularity among the people that even if any number of ships bearing his name were successively sunk, the christening of a new one with the same name will always be greeted with applause. The Führer stated that, according to a telegram received, the government of Bohemia and Moravia had organized a gigantic rally of the Czech people, at which an appeal for complete cooperation with the Greater German Reich was made, and that the appeal had gone on to say that those who in the future held themselves aloof from such cooperation would be branded as traitors to the Czech people. The Führer's remarks on the subject were, this action was initiated during the course of a conversation I had with President Haha in the Reich Chancellery on the occasion of a memorial service for Obergruppenführer Heydrich. I told Haha and the members of the Czech government accompanying him that we would tolerate no further grave acts in the protectorate prejudicial to the interests of the Reich, and that if any occurred, we should have to consider deporting the whole Czech population. I added that as we had accomplished the migration of several million Germans, such an action would present no difficulty to us. At this, Haha collapsed like a pricked balloon, as did also his colleagues. After a pause, they asked whether they might, at least partially and with appropriate discretion, make use of this communication in their own country. As I consider the Czechs to be industrious and intelligent workers and am most anxious to see political stability restored in their country, and particularly in view of the presence therein of two great and most important German armaments factories, I acceded to their request. The fact that the government of the Protectorate has carried out its task in a manner that can only be described as 100% pro-German can be attributed, among other things, to the action of Minister of State Meissner. After the conference, the latter took a walk around the Chancellery Gardens with the Czechs, in the course of which, in answer to their anxious inquiries, he succeeded in persuading them that, as regards the mass deportation of the Czech population, I certainly meant exactly what I had said. The Czech gentlemen were left in so little doubt that they decided forthwith to accept, as the basis of their future policy, that all Beneš intrigues and all pro-Beneš individuals must be stamped out, and that in the future struggle for the survival of the Czech people, there would be no room for neutrals or anyone who remained lukewarm. The Czech government is obviously also relieved that it can at last give the Czech people sound reasons for its action against the Benes party. Haha and his colleagues have never had so favorable a platform from which to launch the slogan, "Who is not for me is against me," and thus to rid themselves of their opponents. In any case, I had the firm impression, when they took their leave, that Haha and his friends were greatly relieved at having been given permission to hint to their people what would be the consequences of an attitude hostile to the interests of the Reich.
Okay. I like that very much.
I did, too. And that Benes fellow comes to play later after the war, a role that exactly you would expect from a guy like that.
Yeah.
As far as persecution of the German people, but...
He bad news, and then the Czechs will not repudiate the, what is it called, the Benes decrees? Decrees, mm-hmm. I mean, the decrees, in which are very anti-German, and they still hold on to those that he came up with back then.
Mm-hmm.
And the German government, our German government now, you know, just doesn't object to anything. It's so wonderful to see Hitler standing up to things, and I actually like the way he put this, that he was going to deport the whole Czech population if they didn't get if they didn't stop. It's not just the government. He said it was the government's responsibility to be pro-German and to stop all this other stuff and to stamp it out, but also to rally the people to how they should be thinking. And if they didn't do it, he was going to deport all the Czechs to a concentration camp or something, and don't think he wouldn't do it, because he would. Well, that got them all shaking in their boots, because they knew that they were the power there. So they held this big rally, and it was pretty successful, and things went along, continued to go along pretty well until the Russians showed up.
Yes, that's right. Well, shall we move on to July 5? Let's
sure.
see here. Okay, July 5th.
I just want to say one little thing I thought about the first half of this. I just want to say that these words of Hitler's about the battleships and naming them and why you shouldn't name them after certain people and so on, it's just more wisdom from the Führer. That really is, you know. Another example of how he thinks about these things that other people don't think about, because his desire for everything to go well for Germany is so strong that nothing escapes his notice. And I think that's very wise what he's saying. He's changing the name of the battlecruiser Deutschland. Because he doesn't want anything to happen to a ship, big battleship named Deutschland.
Sure.
Makes a lot of sense.
And you think about that it really does, because think of a battleship named America, and let's say the Japanese sunk it in the Pacific, and what a psychological detriment that would be. On the other hand, I mean, you could take a battleship Texas or a battleship Oklahoma or Arizona and sink it, and if it's replaced with a new Arizona, everybody's cheering.
It doesn't have the same effect.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, we ready to move?
Yeah.
July 5th, 1942, midday. Frugality of the Italians. Professional out of works. Maritime subsoil and chemical fertilizers. The ambitions of Franco. The stupidity of kings. The frugal habits of the southern Italians are quite extraordinary. There must certainly be a million of them who live on fruit, fish, and the like, literally from hand to mouth. Towns in southern Italy, at least those near the coast, have certainly never known what it is to be hungry, for the sea provides not only fish, but also shellfish of every kind, and goodness knows what else, in quantities quite sufficient for the needs of this frugal people. Such frugality, however, is not without potentially dangerous consequences. The majority of human beings have a leaning towards laissez-faire, and they very quickly lose the zest for endeavor when they find that they can get along very nicely as they are. the 10 or 15,000 professional loafers who were lounging about Germany at the time of our assumption of power and who showed no inclination to take a regular job when once German industry had started to function again have been put into concentration camps. For it is ridiculous to try to deal by ordinary methods with muck of this kind. The fear of being put into a concentration camp has had a most salutary effect, and it greatly facilitated the gearing up of the gigantic industrial activity which our rearmament program demanded. That Germany has succeeded in solving this problem, as it has solved many others, is due in no small measure to the fact that the state has progressively assumed more and more control. Only in this way was it possible to defeat private interests and carry national interests triumphantly to their goal. After the war, equally, we must not let control of the economy of the country slip from our hands. If we do, then once more all the various private interests will concentrate on their own particular objectives. The coastal population, for example, from the viewpoint of life as they see it, still regard land reclamation by means of dam construction as the last word in wisdom. In point of fact, however, land reclamation by this method is the purest folly, for we have all the land we need in the East. On the other hand, enrichment of the soil is still most important, and it must not be impeded by the interests of industry. When once we are convinced that slime from the seabed is, on account of higher nitrogen content, a better fertilizer than any artificial manure, we must transport whole trainloads of it in spite of the protest of our chemical industry. As most people are egotists at heart, any efficient functioning of a national economy is not possible without state direction and control. The Venetian Republic affords an excellent example of how successful a state-directed economy can be. For 500 years, the price of bread in Venice never varied, and it was left to the Jews with their predatory motto of free trade to wreck this stability. The opinion was expressed that the strong pro-monarchist tendencies which had recently been manifest in Spain could perhaps be attributable to the ambition of Franco to obtain, in the event of the restoration of the monarchy, a minor coronet for himself. The Fuhrer disagreed. I disagree entirely. Franco has, I think, sufficient intelligence to realize that any king, if he stopped at that, would at least dismiss him and his followers on the spot, tarnished as they are with the responsibility for the Civil War. Nobody is so monumentally stupid as a king. That I know from my own personal experience. About a year after the victory of our party, one of our former potentates, Ruprecht of Bavaria, sent an emissary to me to say that he was sure I would recognize the necessity of restoring the monarchy. The emissary, following his instructions, went on to say quite frankly that I could not, of course, remain as Reich Chancellor in the restored monarchy because my continued presence would be an obstacle to the unification of the German people. I should, however, be most generously treated and should be rewarded with a dukedom. This fellow was so damn stupid that he could not even see that it was just he himself and his fellow princes who had always been the cause of the disintegration of the German people throughout history, and that never has there been a stronger and more integrated unity of the German races than that which we have achieved under my leadership. And the idiot imagined that some confounded nincompoop could tempt me to give up the leadership of this great people by making me a duke. Yeah,
that was stupid. Can you imagine saying that to him? Wow.
We need to restore the monarchy. And of course, he correctly told him, he didn't tell him, but in his mind, he's saying, hey, that's why we've been disunited and running around like looking after our own interests rather than the nation's. That's the very reason for it. Yep.
Right. Right. Let's see. I'm trying to. There's a couple of thoughts I had. I think I won't forget them, and then I do. This thing about just kind of relates back to the Czech thing, putting people in concentration camps. I love where he says the fear of being put into a concentration camp has had a most salutary effect. And that's so true, you know. These people decide, well, if they're going to get away with loafing around and not doing anything, but if they're going to be put in a camp, maybe they'll get busy, you know, and do something. And you know, it works. And I think that he's not afraid to carry out things like that. He's not afraid he's going to be called names and dictator, or he's going to be called a meanie, or you know, he's not humanitarian enough, and so on. He doesn't worry about that at all. He does what will work. But I thought it was also, you see how he says here, we have all the land we need in the East. Saw it that way. He saw all this.
Sure.
And it wasn't like, people will disagree with me saying this, but it wasn't like he was seeing that we're going to go and steal it from people. But he thought there was so much land there, and that it wasn't being utilized. The way that they could utilize it. They could take some little part of it even and make so much, get so much out of it. Whereas the people who were living there were mainly kind of ignorant peasants who just kind of very slovenly and, you know, had plenty of space there. So they didn't have much else, and they didn't do all that much with it. So people who say he was going to go and wanted to steal the property, what you call these other people's countries and turn them into slaves and servants, it wasn't going to be that way, even though he did say that the Germans were going to have to be the people in charge, and they would in order to make it all work out right, that the people that were there were not going to do that. I just find some of these things that crop up in his language pretty interesting. And he also mentions free trade and that it's Jewish.
Yes. And we know what free trade has done to economic independence of the United States.
Right.
Sovereignty, as you know, it's a shot. So, yeah, you know, and he's talking about that land of the East, of course, the territory, and he's talking about places like Ukraine and other areas that are not very sparsely populated, and the people that live on that land eke out an existence for themselves and their families, and that's it. And, of course, what could happen if the Germans took that over? And as he talked about earlier, people moving out there and setting up communities, and how many tons of wheat and crops and all could be that land that is sitting there producing nothing, and you know, the people that would live there, would they be upset about that? Heck no. If the Germans came in and turned it into a real breadbasket, a production of wheat and other grains, they would benefit, because it'd be a heck of a lot better than what they had just as feeding themselves. And so to think that this is going to be a mean thing is totally a false picture of it.
Yeah, and these people would have opportunities that they did not,
they
never had before, and they would have them, you know.
Sure.
So, you know,
I've been a lot less hungry people.
Yeah, he mentioned the frugal Southern Italians, and there are a lot of people who think this way. This is kind of a point of debate, I suppose, how we should live. Should we live to try to improve everything and be industrious and create larger populations, which, of course, the Germans wanted to increase their population, and build and, you know, invent things and have progress and so on, which there's a lot of good that comes from that, I'll tell you. But on the other hand, you have this, well, let's just live simply, and we can live, we don't need all this stuff, and particularly if you live in a good climate where you have, you know, a lot of natural resources, and you can grow and, you know, get food easily. But we know that that's why the Southerners didn't do as much, because it was easy for them to find food and to live without working like the Northerners had to do. And it made them, they didn't develop their intelligence as much, and they didn't develop their civilization as well. Although Southern Italy had a lot of great civilizations, but if you go further south than that. So it brings up an interesting point, and people have very different outlooks
right.
on that. Yeah. I sympathize with both of them. I'd like to have a kind of good balance.
I do too. You know, I think that's good too. That each side has its good points.
Right.
Well, now we come to the section that I found the most fascinating. All of this is good, but boy, this one really has some wonderful stuff in it that is going to lend for some good discussion. And this is still July the 5th, 1942, in the evening. Falsification of war communiques. Switzerland believes the Jewish lies. No foe in Europe compares with the British. But National Socialist Germany will beat them in the end. Britain in the hands of the Jews. Conservation of our racial integrity. Farcical success of St. Paul. Commenting on a completely false Soviet war communique, which had been published in the Swedish and Swiss press, as well as in that of Britain and America, the Führer said, "These communiques are typical Jewish fabrications. Although they do not even give names of places, they are nevertheless published by news agencies all over the world. And the explanation is, of course, that these agencies themselves are, for the most part, in the hands of Jews. Unfortunately, this Jewish twaddle is being accepted without question, not only in Britain and America, but also in Sweden and Switzerland. The reason why the Jews and their fabrications find such credence becomes apparent if you take a look at a country like Switzerland. In that country, Tom has milk interest. Dick follows the prices of the grain market. Harry exports watches. In these circumstances, even old Wilhelm Tell himself could not maintain the military spirit at any high level. As a result, military knowledge has been so discounted that any Swiss officer who shows a true appreciation of the facts of this war is immediately relieved of his command. In Germany, one of the primary services rendered by the NSDAP is its success in restoring to the people the emphatic conviction that perpetual military training of the rising generations must always continue. If this spirit is to be maintained, it is essential that those who have distinguished themselves, either by great successes in the field or as men of very wide experience in war, should be made available as models and instructors for the rising generation. The reserve of officers must be carefully nourished, for in the military training of the individual, the reserve officers, the living incarnations of the martial spirit of our race, have an incomparable military duty towards the whole people. Apart from this, the schools and other centers of instruction must in all circumstances foster that interest, an interest, by the way, which remained active even during the Weimar Republic, which Germans have always shown in the connection between science and the military art. I have always been an ardent disciple of the belief that in a struggle between peoples, the people with a higher average morale must always emerge victorious. In my opinion, that an inferior people should triumph over a strong is a negation of the laws of nature. The British maintained their position of world domination for 300 years solely because there was, during that period, nothing on the continent comparable in race or intelligence to oppose them. Napoleon himself was no real menace to them because, in the frenzy of the French Revolution, he had no solid basis on which to found a new order in Europe. And apart from him, there has never been in Europe, since the disintegration of the old German Empire, any state which, in either quantity or quality, could compare with the British. Thanks to the development of National Socialist Germany, I firmly believe, if only on purely biological grounds, we shall succeed in surpassing the British to such an extent that, with 150 to 200 million Germans, we shall become the undisputed masters of the whole of Europe. A recrudescence of the problem of Rome or Carthage in the new guise of Germany or Great Britain is not, in my opinion, possible. For the result of this war will be that, whereas in Britain, each additional million of population will be an additional burden on the island itself, the increasing growth of our own races will have opened to them horizons of political and ethnological expansion which are limitless. Further, any alleviation of the overcrowding of towns by a movement back to the land is not possible in Britain, for this would necessitate an immediate revolution of the whole social system of the kingdom, which in its turn would lead to the disintegration of the rest of the empire. These very important facts have been largely overlooked in Britain because the country is ruled not by men of intelligence, but by Jews, as one must realize when one sees how the intrigues of the Jews in Palestine are accepted in Britain without comment or demur. One of our most important tasks will be to save future generations from a similar political fate and to maintain forever watchful in them a knowledge of the menace of Jewry. For this reason alone, it is vital that the Passion Play be continued at Oberammergau, for never has the menace of Jewry been so convincingly portrayed as in this presentation of what happened in the times of the Romans. There one sees in Pontius Pilate a Roman, racially and intellectually, so superior that he stands out like a firm, clean rock in the middle of the whole muck and mire of Jewry. The preservation of our racial purity can be assured only by an awareness of the racial issues involved. Our laws, therefore, must be framed with the sole object of protecting our people not only against Jewish, but also against any and every racial infection. We must do all we can to foster this racial awareness until it attains the same standard as obtained in Rome in the days of her glory. In those days, the Roman protected himself subconsciously against any racial adulteration. The same thing occurred in Greece at the height of her power. According to reports handed down to us, the very marketplace itself in Athens shook with laughter when St. Paul spoke there in favor of the Jews. If nowadays we do not find the same splendid pride of race which distinguished the Grecian and Roman eras, it is because in the 4th century, these Jewish Christians systematically destroyed all the monuments of these ancient civilizations. It was they, too, who destroyed the library at Alexandria. Anyway, I think that's a wonderful section.
Well, tell us what you like of what you like about it.
One of the things that really jumped at me, Carolyn, was where he says, "I have always been an ardent disciple of the belief that in a struggle between peoples, the people with the higher average morale must always emerge victorious." And then he says, "In my opinion, that an inferior people should triumph over a strong is a negation of the laws of nature." That is such a powerful, powerful statement and such a truism of exactly what happened with World War II. An inferior people triumphs over a stronger one. And that was, to me, a negation of the real laws of nature.
Well, how did it happen then? I thought he was saying that it can't happen, pretty much.
That's right. And what, to me, that sentence where the people with a higher average morale must always emerge victorious, that morale being a pride in oneself and in one's nation, and the extreme willingness to go the ultimate sacrifice to see that that nation carried on. And then when the Germans were finally overwhelmed by superior numbers and industrial output made possible by the United States, cut to the chase, in my opinion, the good guys lost that war. The people with the best cause, with the most righteous struggle, lost that war. And what's the German word for it? The triumph of the Untermenschen, you know?
Yeah. But we're talking about morale. I think that, always when you're winning, or if you think you're winning, or if you think you're doing well, you have good morale. If you start to see differently, or you start to...
Yes.
Have this, of course this was later on, but later on in the war, everybody understood that it was almost probably not possible for them to win anymore. Then your morale goes down. and you're not going to do as well, even if you fight like heck, you know.
That's right.
So, but I think that it's interesting because I was thinking, well, it must be very difficult to take the victory of the Soviets then if the better people, you know, always emerge victorious. But that's not what he's saying. He's saying the people with the higher average morale. And morale was really, that's why he was also so angry at the church and people like Bishop von Galen and like the White the White Rose Society and all these treasonous people who were trying to destroy the morale of the German people, really. Well, I wouldn't say von Galen was trying to destroy it, but these White Rose people were, because they wanted Germany to lose. They wanted the war to go badly. They wanted all that to happen. And so he was very harsh with these people, and they made him very angry because he believed that, and rightly, that morale was very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I noticed also here that when he, several times in this, not just in this little section, but in previous one, he talks, says the German races. He makes it plural.
Yes. Yeah, that was going to be my second point there. That's
okay,
so powerful about the, well, he says the preservation of our racial purity can be assured only by an awareness of the racial issues involved and, you know, and protect ourselves against those different from us that could infect our people. And we have to foster this racial awareness in that the Romans were so, let's say, aware of their own superiority that they protected themselves even subconsciously against any racial adulteration. And to me, that was the second big point of this particular section.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, he brings that out again. Very, I think, you know, I'm always happy to see that when he's saying that.
Me too, the pride of race.
Yeah. Well, but what I was getting at, though, was that he says the German races. He doesn't say the German race. And, of course, his thinking, their use of the word race is not like a white, yellow, black race. It's it's more like a racial strains and, you know.
Yes. That's exactly right.
National, different origins from different places. So he is very, by saying it that way, if he really did say it that way, he's very cognizant right now in 42 that that Germany is made up, the German people are made up of a number of racial strains, number of racial types, not types, I shouldn't say that, that's wrong, but from different
well,
areas.
Racial strains, I mean.
Yeah, racial strains
you know,
is good. And and that's something that is, I think, important to him because he it's all about how they all have to be united, and they have been united.
That's right.
So
that's
the
exactly
people
right.
Don't all have the very exact. They don't, you know, different areas of Germany people have are a little different, but they've all been united into what he considers and what they consider themselves to be as German, and it's a very distinct thing. It's not something flexible or that you can will change around and other new things can come into it, but it as it is now is what he sees as the permanent German people. Because you know there's been debate about that, so I just thought I'd bring that up.
Well, that's a good point. And you know when he mentions here, Carolyn, if nowadays we don't find this same splendid pride of race which distinguished the Grecian and Roman eras, it's because in the 4th century these Jewish Christians systematically destroyed all the monuments of these ancient civilizations. It went by the boards. And that falls right back over here to the paragraph where, to me anyway, it says, the triumph of an inferior people, then, it's a negation of the laws of nature. I mean, you look back with the
so
ancient ruins.
So what did he say, an inferior people? Did he say that, too?
Yeah, it's the, yeah he says, in my opinion, that an inferior people should triumph over a strong is a negation of the laws of nature. And what he's talking about the Greeks and the Romans and their great buildings, their great accomplishments and everything, they're not there anymore. because they were overcome, and their sense of racial pride and all was diluted along the way, and they lost it. And anyway, that's just my opinion. That's what kind of struck me with a lot of these
words.
Well,
then what about, what would he say then about the triumph of the Soviets over the Germans in the East? Because he does think that the Russians are an inferior people to the Germans.
Yeah.
So
that
was kind of a comeuppance, you know, if he's saying something like that. I still haven't found that exact phrase here.
Yeah.
I was looking at that other one where he said the morale, talked about morale, higher average morale. Oh, here, the next sentence. In my opinion, that an inferior people should triumph over strong is negated. Boy, I'm sorry I didn't catch that. So how does he explain all that? Because it happens a lot. And right now we've been triumphed over by the Jews.
Yeah, that's right. And that's an aberration of nature. And that's a negation of the laws of nature. But, we could debate that all night. We're allowing it to happen and things like this. So,
yeah.
You know, that opens a whole lot of areas of discussion. But
yeah, well, it's not as simple as that then. It's not as
right.
simple as to say an inferior mm-hmm. people, because how do you define that and so on?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they're in conversation. We can't parse this stuff too much.
You know, I think that in Hitler's mind, the racial brethren, if you want to call it that, the racial brethren, the British, the German, the Russian, the real Russian, had a lot in common and were of the same strain.
But you know, with the Russian you talk about, the West, they were ruled over by Germans, the royal families or the Tsar
yes,
families and so on. Or were mostly German with some other Western European stuff in them.
Yeah.
Because, and he always thought that the Russians weren't capable of being real leaders, the pure Russian.
Well, just as the Germans learned from the British, and like Hitler was an admirer of the British Empire and what they accomplished mm-hmm. and all that, he looked at the British. He obviously, the Germans didn't have that. So he thought they're doing something that we aren't, and they're doing it in a way that is admirable. And I think that the Russians were a step behind the Germans in that same way, and that the potential was there for them to be brought up to that next level and all, but they had, they've been backward economically, country.
I don't look at it that way because I think that they're different. I think that mm-hmm. the real Russian is a Slav and is different from the Germanic people. And while mm-hmm. they have a lot of great qualities and abilities and so on, organizational running a state is not one of them. Not that some of them couldn't learn, but they obviously kept relying on foreigners to do it. So it's just a different, I think of the Cossacks and so on. They have a lot of noble character, and there
right.
are a lot of great fighters or noble people. You know, I'm not putting down, but as far as
I understand that, yeah.
organizing a state, and maybe they just have a different way of organizing. They have a different way of life
mm-hmm.
from the West. And going back to what we were talking about before, about to be live off the land or to be more aggressively
yeah.
modernizing things and so on, it's not necessarily a question of one is better. They're different. Anyway, I'm just going by what I think Hitler's thoughts were, which a lot of people don't like for that reason, but I think that's what he thought. Well, Ray, we're going to get farther, but you were right again. This is as far as we got tonight.
Well, I was very, very pleased that we got that last section in, and our listeners are going to have something to certainly look forward to again next week, because I read a little bit ahead here, probably about 8 or 9 pages, and there's more, once again, more good stuff, and so I'm glad that people tuned us in tonight. I really enjoyed this evening and bouncing this stuff back and forth with you and reading what the Fuhrer has to say. Hey, it's like a great outing. I've enjoyed it.
Yes, it's a great treat for me too. Well, all right. Thanks, Ray, for your comments there, and thank you, listeners. And we'll see you once again next week. This is Hitler's Table Talk on January 22nd, 2015. Good night.
Good night.